The two of them walked back in the direction from which they had come without another word. They did look back over their shoulders from time to time, however, and they were still holding hands. Hansel and Gretel, lost in the deep, dark forest. "Let me out of here," Eddie said heavily. He made the Ruger safe, stuck it back in the waistband of his pants, and then rubbed his red eyes with the heels of his hands. "Just let me out, that's all I ask."
"I know what you mean, handsome."
She was clearly scared, but her head had that defiant tilt he had come to recognize and love. He put his hands on her shoulders, bent down, and kissed her. He did not let either their surroundings or the oncoming storm keep him from doing a thorough job. When he pulled back, at last, she was studying him with wide, dancing eyes.
"Wow! What was that about?"
"About how I'm in love with you," he said.
"And I guess that's about all. Is it enough?"
Her eyes softened. For a moment she thought about telling him the secret she might or might not be keeping, but of course the time and place were wrong. She could no more tell him she might be pregnant now than she could pause to read the words written on the sculpted portal totems.
"It's enough, Eddie," she said.
"You're the best thing that ever happened to me." His hazel eyes were totally focused on her.
"It's hard for me to say stuff like that. Living with Henry made it hard, I guess, but it's true. I think I started loving you because you were everything Roland took me away from. In New York, I mean. But it's a lot more than that now. Because I don't want to go back anymore, do you?"
She looked at the cradle. She was terrified of what they might find in there, but all the same, she looked back at him.
"No, I don't want to go back. I want to spend the rest of my life going forward. As long as you're with me, that is. It's funny, you know, you saying you started loving me because of all the things he took you away from.
Funny how?
I started loving you because you set me free a dead a walker."
She paused, thought, then shook her head slightly.
"No, it goes further than that. I started loving you because you set me free of both those bitches. One was a foul-mouthed, cock-teasing thief, and the other was a self-righteous, pompous prig. Comes down to six of one and a half dozen of the other, as far as I'm concerned. I like Susanna Dean better than either one, and you were the one who set me free."
This time it was she who did the reaching, pressing her palm to his stubbly cheeks, drawing him down, kissing him gently. When he put a light hand on her breast, she sighed and covered it with her own.
"I think we better get going," she said, "or we're apt to be laying right here in the street, and getting wet from the look."
Eddie stared around at the silent towers, the broken windows, the vine-encrusted walls a final time. Then he nodded.
"Yeah, I don't think there's any future in this town anyway."
He pushed her forward, and they both stiffened as the wheels of the chair passed over what Maud had called the deadline, fearful that they would trip some ancient protective device and die together. But nothing happened. Eddie pushed her into the plaza, and as they approached the steps leading up to the cradle, a cold, wind-driven rain began to fall. Although neither of them knew it, the first of the great autumn storms of Midworld had arrived. 25. Once they were in the smelly darkness of the sewers, Gasher slowed the killing pace he'd maintained above ground. Jake didn't think it was because of the darkness. Gasher seemed to know every twist and turn of the route he was following, just as advertised. Jake believed it was because his captor was satisfied that Roland had been squashed to jelly by the deadfall trap. Jake himself had begun to wonder. If Roland had spotted the tripwires, a far more subtle trap than the one which followed, was it really likely that he had missed seeing the fountain? Jake supposed it was possible, but it didn't make much sense. Jake thought it more likely that Roland had tripped the fountain on purpose, to lull Gasher and perhaps slow him down. He didn't believe Roland could follow them through this maze under the streets. The total darkness would defeat even the gunslinger's tracking abilities, but it cheered his heart to think that Roland might not have died in an attempt to keep his promise. They turned right, left, then left again. As Jake's other senses sharpened in an attempt to compensate for his lack of sight, he had a vague perception of other tunnels around him. The muffled sounds of ancient laboring machinery would grow loud for a moment, then fade as the stone foundations of the city drew close around them again. Drafts blew intermittently against his skin, sometimes warm, sometimes chilly. Their splashing footfalls echoed briefly as they passed the intersecting tunnels from which these stenchy breaths blew, and once Jake nearly brained himself on some metal object jutting down from the ceiling. He slapped at it with one hand and felt something that might have been a large valve wheel. After that, he waved his hands as he trotted along in an attempt to read the air ahead of him. Gasher guided him with taps to the shoulders as a wagoner might have guided his oxen. They moved at a good clip, trotting but not running. Gasher got enough of his breath back to first hum and then begin singing in a low, surprisingly tuneful tenor voice. Rebel to tibble to ting ting ting, I'll get a job and buy you a ring. When I get my mitts on your jiggly tits, rebel to tibble to ting ting ting. Oh, rebel to tibble, I just want to fiddle, fiddle around with your ting ting ting. There were five or six more verses along this line before Gasher quit. Now you sing something, Squint.
I don't know anything, Jake puffed. He hoped he sounded more out of breath than he actually was.
He didn't know if it would do him any good or not, but down here in the dark any edge seemed worth trying for. Gasher brought his elbow down in the center of Jake's back, almost hard enough to send him sprawling into the ankle-high water running sluggishly through the tunnel they were traversing.
You better know something, unless you want me to rip your ever-loving spine right out your back.
He paused, then added,
There's haunts down here, boy. They live inside the fucking machine, so they do. Singing keeps them off, don't you know that? Now sing!
Jake thought hard, not wanting to earn another love tap from Gasher, and came up with a song he'd learned in summer day camp at the age of 7 or 8. He opened his mouth and began to bawl it into the darkness, listening to the echoes bounce back amid the sounds of running water, falling water, and ancient thudding machinery.
My girl's a corker, she's a New Yorker. I buy her everything to keep her in style. She got a pair of hips just like two battleships. Oh boy, that's how my money goes. My girl's a dilly, she comes from Philly. I buy her everything to keep her in style. She's got a pair of eyes just like two pizza pies. Oh boy, that's how
Gasher reached out, seized Jake's ears as if they were jug handles, and yanked him to a stop.
"There's a hole right ahead of you," he said. "With a voice like yours, Squint, it'd be doing the world a mercy to let you fall in, so it would. But TikTok wouldn't approve at all, so I reckon you're safe for a little longer."
Gasher's hands left Jake's ears, which burned like fire, and fastened on the back of his shirt.
"Now lean forward until you feel the ladder on t'other side, and mind you don't slip and drag us both down."
Jake leaned cautiously forward, hands outstretched, terrified of falling into a pit he couldn't see. As he groped for the ladder, he became aware of warm air, clean and almost fragrant, whooshing past his face, and a faint blush of rose-colored light from beneath him. His fingers touched a steel rung and closed over it. The bite wounds on his left hand broke open again, and he felt warm blood running across his palm.
"Got it?" Gasher asked.
"Yes."
"Then climb down. What are you waiting for, goddammit?"
Gasher let go of his shirt, and Jake could imagine him drawing his foot back, meaning to hurry him along with a kick in the ass. Jake stepped across the faintly glimmering gap and began to descend the ladder, using his hurt hand as little as possible. This time the rungs were clear of moss and oil and hardly rusted at all. The shaft was very long, and as Jake went down, hurrying to keep Gasher from stepping on his hands with his thick-soled boots, he found himself remembering a movie he'd once seen on TV, Journey to the Center of the Earth. The throb of machinery grew louder, and the rosy glow grew stronger. The machine still didn't sound right, but his ears told him these were in better shape than the ones above. And when he finally reached the bottom, he found the floor was dry. The new horizontal shaft was square, about 6 feet high, and sleeved with riveted stainless steel. It stretched away, for as far as Jake could see in both directions, straight as a string. He knew instinctively, without even thinking about it, that this tunnel, which had to be at least 70 feet under Ludd, also followed the path of the beam. And somewhere up ahead, Jake was sure of this, although he couldn't have said why, the train they had come looking for lay directly above it. Narrow ventilation grills ran along the sides of the walls just below the shaft ceiling. It was from these that the clean, dry air was flowing. Moss dangled from some of them in blue-gray beards, but most were still clear. Below every other grill was a yellow arrow with a symbol that looked a bit like a lowercase T. The arrows pointed in the direction Jake and Gasher were heading. The rose-colored light was coming from glass tubes which ran along the ceiling of the shaft in parallel rows. Some, about one in every three, were dark, and others sputtered fitfully, but at least half of them were still working. Neon tubing, Jake thought, amazed. How about that? Gasher dropped down beside him. He saw Jake's expression of surprise and grinned.
Nice, isn't it? Cool in the summer, warm in the winter, and so much food that 500 men couldn't eat it in 500 years. And do you know the best part, Squint? The very best part of the whole koozie fakement?
Jake shook his head.
Farkin' pubies don't have the leastest idea the place even exists. They think there's monsters down here. Catch a pubie going within 20 feet of a sewer cap less than he has to.
He threw his head back and laughed heartily. Jake didn't join in, even though a cold voice in the back of his mind told him it might be politic to do so. He didn't join in because he knew exactly how the pubes felt. There were monsters under the city. Trolls and boggarts and orcs. Hadn't he been captured by just such a one? Gasher shoved him to the left.
Garn! Almost there now. Up!
They jogged on, their footfalls chasing them in a pack of echoes. After 10 or 15 minutes of this, Jake saw a watertight hatchway about 200 yards ahead. As they drew closer, he could see a big valve wheel sticking out of it. A communicator box was mounted on the wall to the right.
"I'm blown out!" Gasher gasped as they reached the door at the end of the tunnel. "Doings like this are too much for an invalid like your old pal, so they are."
He thumbed the button on the intercom and bawled,
"I got him, Tick-Tock! Got him as dandy as please! Didn't even muss his hair! Didn't I tell you I would? Trust the Gasher man, I said, for he'll lead you straight and true. Now open up and let us in!"
He let go of the button and looked impatiently at the door. The valve wheel didn't turn. Instead, a flat, drawling voice came out of the intercom speaker. "What's a password?" Gasher frowned horribly, scratched his chin with his long, dirty nails, then lifted his eye patch and swabbed out another clot of yellow-green goo.
"Tick-tock and his passwords," he said to Jake. He sounded worried as well as irritated. "He's a trig cove, but that's taking it a deal too far, if you ask me, so it is."
He pushed the button and yelled,
"Come on, Tick-tock, if you don't recognize the sound of my voice, you need a hearing aid." "Oh, I recognize it," the drawling voice returned.
To Jake, it sounded like Jerry Reed, who played Burt Reynolds' sidekick in Smokey and the Bandit.
"But I don't know who's with you, do I? Or have you forgotten that the camera out there went tits up last year? You give the password, Gasher, or you can rot out there."
Gasher stuck a finger up his nose, extracted a chunk of snot the color of mint jelly, and squashed it into the grill of the speaker. Jake watched this childish display of ill temper in silent fascination, feeling unwelcome hysterical laughter bubbling around inside him. Had they come all this way through the booby-trapped mazes and lightless tunnels to be balked here at this watertight door simply because Gasher couldn't remember the TikTok man's password? Gasher looked at him balefully, then slid his hand across his skull, peeling off his sweat-soaked yellow scarf. The skull beneath was bald, except for a few straggling tufts of black hair like porcupine quills, and deeply dented above the left temple. Gasher peered into the scarf and plucked forth a scrap of paper.
"God bless Hoots," he muttered. "Hoots takes care of me right proper, he does."
He peered at the scrap, turning it this way and that, and then held it out to Jake. He kept his voice pitched low, as if the TikTok man could hear him, even though the talk button on the intercom wasn't depressed.
"You're a proper little gentleman, ain't you? And the very first thing they teach a gentleman to do after he's been learned not to eat the paste and piss in the corners is read. So read me the word on this paper, Cali, for it's gone right out of my head, so it has."
Jake took the paper, looked at it, then looked up at Gasher again. "What if I won't?" he asked coolly. Gasher was momentarily taken aback at this response, and then he began to grin with dangerous good humor.
"Why, I'll grab you by the throat and use your head for a door knocker," he said. "I doubt if it'll convince old Ticky to let me in, for he's still nervous of your hard-case friend, so he is. But it'll do my heart a world of good to see your brains dripping off that wheel."
Jake considered this, the dark laughter still bubbling away inside him. The TikTok man was a trig enough cove, all right. He had known that it would be difficult to persuade Gasher, who was dying anyway, to speak the password, even if Roland had taken him prisoner. What TikTok hadn't taken into account was Gasher's defective memory. "Don't laugh. If you do, he really will beat your brains out." In spite of his brave words, Gasher was watching Jake with real anxiety, and Jake realized a potentially powerful fact. Gasher might not be afraid of dying, but he was afraid of being humiliated. "All right, Gasher," he said calmly. "The word on this piece of paper is bountiful."
"Give me that!"
Gasher snatched the paper back, returned it to his scarf, and quickly wrapped the yellow cloth around his head again. He thumbed the intercom button.
"Tick-tock, you're still there?"
"Where else would I be, the west end of the world?" The drawling voice now sounded mildly amused. Gasher stuck his whitish tongue out at the speaker, but his voice was ingratiating, almost servile.
"The password's bountiful, and a fine word it is, too. Now let me in, gods cuss it."
"Of course," the TikTok man said. A machine started up somewhere nearby, making Jake jump. The valve wheel in the center of the door spun. When it stopped, Gasher seized it, yanked it outward, grabbed Jake's arm, and propelled him over the raised lip of the door and into the strangest room he had ever seen in his life. 26. Roland descended into dusky pink light. Oi's bright eyes peered out from the open V of his shirt, his neck stretched to the limit of its considerable length as he sniffed at the warm air that blew through the ventilator grills. Roland had had to depend completely on the bumbler's nose in the dark passages above, and he had been terribly afraid the animal would lose Jake's scent in the running water. But when he had heard the sound of singing, first Gasher, then Jake, echoing back through the pipes, he had relaxed a little. Oi had not led them wrong. Oi had heard it, too. Up until then, he had been moving slowly and cautiously, even backtracking every now and again to be sure of himself. But when he heard Jake's voice, he began to run, straining the rawhide leash. Roland was afraid he might call after Jake in his harsh voice, "Ake, ake!" But he hadn't done so. And, just as they reached the shaft which led to the lower levels of this Dicean maze, Roland had heard the sound of some new machine, a pump of some sort, perhaps, followed by the metallic, echoing crash of a door being slammed shut. He reached the foot of the square tunnel and glanced briefly at the double line of lighted tubes which led off in either direction. They were lit with swamp fire, he saw, like the sign outside the place which had belonged to Balazar in the city of New York. He looked more closely at the narrow chrome ventilation strips running along the top of each wall and the arrows below them, then slipped the rawhide loop off Oi's neck. Oi shook his head impatiently, clearly glad to be rid of it. "We're close," he murmured into the bumbler's cocked ear, "and so we have to be quiet. You understand, Oi? Very quiet."
"Quiet,"
Oi replied in a hoarse whisper that would have been funny under other circumstances. Roland put him down, and Oi was immediately off down the tunnel, neck out, muzzle to the steel floor. Roland could hear him muttering, "Ick-ick, ick-ick," under his breath. Roland unholstered his gun and followed him. 27. Eddie and Susanna looked up at the vastness of Blaine's cradle as the skies opened and the rain began to fall in torrents.
It's a hell of a building, but they forgot the handicap ramps,
Eddie yelled, raising his voice to be heard over the rain and thunder.
Never mind that, Susanna said, impatiently, slipping out of the wheelchair. Let's get up there and out of the rain.
Eddie looked dubiously up the incline of steps. The risers were shallow, but there were a lot of them.
You sure, Suze? Race, you white boy, she said, and began to wriggle upward with uncanny ease, using hands, muscular forearms, and the stumps of her legs.
And she almost did beat him. Eddie had the ironmongery to contend with, and it slowed him down. Both of them were panting when they reached the top, and tendrils of steam were rising from their wet clothes. Eddie grabbed her under the arms, swung her up, and then just held her with his hands locked together in the small of her back instead of dropping her back into the chair as he had meant to do. He felt randy and half crazy without the slightest idea why.
"Oh, give me a break," he thought. "You've gotten this far alive. That's what's got your glands pumped up and ready to potty."
Susanna licked her full lower lip and wound her strong fingers into his hair. She pulled. It hurt, and at the same time it felt wonderful. "Told you I'd beat you, white boy," she said in a low, husky voice.
"Get out of here. I had you by half a step."
He tried to sound less out of breath than he was and found it was impossible.
"Maybe, but it blew you out, didn't it?"
One hand left his hair, slid downward, and squeezed gently. A smile gleamed in her eyes.
"Something ain't blown out, though."
Thunder rumbled across the sky. They flinched, then laughed together.
"Come on," he said. "This is nuts. The time's all wrong."
She didn't contradict him, but she squeezed him again before returning her hand to his shoulder. Eddie felt a pang of regret as he swung her back into her chair and ran her across vast flagstones and under cover of the roof. He thought he saw the same regret in Susanna's eyes. When they were out of the downpour, Eddie paused and they looked back. The plaza of the cradle, the street of the turtle, and all the city beyond was rapidly disappearing into a shifting gray curtain. Eddie wasn't a bit sorry. Lud hadn't earned itself a place in his mental scrapbook of fond memories.
"Look," Susanna murmured.
She was pointing at a nearby downspout. It ended in a large, scaly fish head that looked like a close relation to the dragon gargoyles which decorated the corners of the cradle. Water ran from its mouth in a silver torrent.
"This isn't just a passing shower, is it?" Eddie asked.
"Nope. It's gonna rain until it gets tired of it, and then it's gonna rain some more just for spite. Maybe a week, maybe a month. Not that it's going to matter to us if Blaine decides he doesn't like our looks and fries us. Fire a shot to let Roland know we got here, sugar, and then we'll have us a look around, see what we can see."
Eddie pointed the Ruger into the gray sky, pulled the trigger, and fired the shot which Roland heard a mile or more away as he followed Jake and Gasher through the booby-trapped maze. Eddie stood where he was a moment longer, trying to persuade himself that things might still turn out all right, that his heart was wrong in its stubborn insistence that they had seen the last of the gunslinger and the boy Jake. Then he made the automatic safe again, returned it to the waistband of his pants, and went back to Susanna. He turned her chair away from the steps and rolled her along an aisle of columns which led deeper into the building. She popped the cylinder of Roland's gun and reloaded it as they went. Under the roof, the rain had a secret, ghostly sound, and even the harsh thunder cracks were muted. The columns which supported the structure were at least 10 feet in diameter, and their tops were lost in the gloom. From up there in the shadows, Eddie heard the cooing conversation of pigeons. Now a sign hanging on thick chrome-silver chains swam out of the shadows. North Central Positronics welcomes you to the cradle of Lud. Southeast Travel, Blaine. Northwest Travel, Patricia.
"Now we know the name of the one that fell in the river," Eddie said. "Patricia. They got their colors wrong, though. Supposed to be pink for girls and blue for boys, not the other way around."
"Maybe they're both blue."
"They're not. Blaine's pink."
"How would you know that?"
Eddie looked confused.
"I don't know how, but I do."
They followed the arrow pointing toward Blaine's berth, entering what had to be a grand concourse. Eddie didn't have Susanna's ability to see the past in clear, visionary flashes, but his imagination nonetheless filled this vast pillared space with a thousand hurrying people. He heard clicking heels and murmuring voices, saw embraces of homecoming and farewell. And over everything, the speakers chanting news of a dozen different destinations. "Patricia is now boarding for Northwest Baronese. Will passenger Killington, passenger Killington, please report to the information booth on the lower level. Blaine is now arriving at berth number 2 and will be debarking shortly." Now, there was only the pigeons. Eddie shivered.
"Look at the faces," Susanna murmured.
"I don't know if they give you the willies, but they sure do me."
She was pointing to the right. High up on the wall, a series of sculpted heads seemed to push out of the marble, peering down at them from the shadows. Stern men with the harsh faces of executioners who are happy in their work. Some of the faces had fallen from their places and lay in granite shards and splinters 70 or 80 feet below their peers. Those remaining were spider-webbed with cracks and splattered with pigeon dung.
"They must have been the Supreme Court or something," Eddie said, uneasily scanning all those thin lips and cracked, empty eyes. "Only judges can look so smart and so completely pissed off at the same time. You're talking to a guy who knows. There isn't one of them who looks like he'd give a crippled crab a crutch."
"A heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter," Susanna murmured,
and at these words Eddie felt goose flesh waltz across the skin of his arms and chest and legs.
"What's that, Suze?" "A poem by a man who must have seen Lud in his dreams," she said. "Come on, Eddie, forget him."
"Easier said than done."
But he began to push her again. Ahead, a vast grilled barrier like a castle barbican swam out of the gloom, and beyond it, they caught their first glimpse of Blaine the Mono. It was pink, just as Eddie had said it would be, a delicate shade which matched the veins running through the marble pillars. Blaine flowed above the wide loading platform in a smooth, streamlined bullet shape, which looked more like flesh than metal. Its surface was broken only once by a triangular window equipped with a huge wiper. Eddie knew there would be another triangular window with another big wiper on the other side of the Mono's nose, so that if you looked at Blaine head-on, it would seem to have a face, just like Charlie the Choo-Choo. The wipers would look like slyly drooping eyelids. White light from the southeastern slot in the cradle fell across Blaine in a long, distorted rectangle. To Eddie, the body of the train looked like the breaching back of some fabulous pink whale, one that was utterly silent.
"Wow." His voice had fallen to a whisper. "We found it." "Yes. Blaine the Mono."
"Is it dead, do you think?"
"It looks dead." "It's not. Sleeping, maybe, but a long way from dead."
"You sure?"
"Were you sure it would be pink?"
It wasn't a question he had to answer, and he didn't. The face she turned up to him was strained and badly frightened.
"It's sleeping, and you know what? I'm scared to wake it up."
"Well, we'll wait for the others, then."
She shook her head.
"I think we better try to be ready for when they get here, because I've got an idea that they're going to come on the run. Push me over to that box mounted on the bars. It looks like an intercom. See it?"
He did, and pushed her slowly toward it. It was mounted on one side of a closed gate in the center of the barrier which ran the length of the cradle. The vertical bars of the barrier were made of what looked like stainless steel. Those of the gate appeared to be ornamental iron, and their lower ends disappeared into steel-ringed holes in the floor. There was no way either of them was going to wiggle through those bars either, Eddie saw. The gap between each set was no more than 4 inches. It would have been a tight squeeze even for Oi. Pigeons ruffled and cooed overhead. The left wheel of Susanna's chair squawked monotonously.
"My kingdom for an oil can," Eddie thought, and realized he was a lot more than just scared.
The last time he had felt this level of terror had been on the day when he and Henry had stood on the sidewalk of Reinhold Street in Dutch Hill, looking at the slumped ruin of the mansion. They hadn't gone in on that day in 1977. They had turned their backs on the haunted house and walked away, and he remembered vowing to himself that he would never, never, ever go back to that place. It was a promise he'd kept, but here he was, in another haunted house, and there was the haunter, right over there, Blaine the Mono, a long, low, pink shape with one window peering at him like the eye of a dangerous animal who is shamming sleep.
He stirs no more from his birth in the cradle. He has even stopped speaking in his many voices and laughing. Artis was the last to go nigh Blaine, and when Artis couldn't answer what was asked, Blaine slew him with blue fire.
If it speaks to me, I'll probably go crazy, Eddie thought.
The wind gusted outside, and a fine spray of rain flew in through the tall egress slot cut in the side of the building. He saw it strike Blaine's window and beat up there. Eddie shuddered suddenly and looked sharply around.
"We're being watched. I can feel it."
"I wouldn't be at all surprised. Push me closer to the gate, Eddie. I want to get a better look at that box."
"Okay, but don't touch it if it's electrified."
"If Blaine wants to cook us, he will," Susanna said, looking through the bars at Blaine's back. "You know it, and I do too."
And because Eddie knew that was only the truth, he said nothing. The box looked like a combination intercom and burglar alarm. There was a speaker set into the top half with what looked like a talk-listen button next to it. Below this were numbers arranged in a shape which made a diamond. Under the diamond were two other buttons with words of the high speech printed on them, Command and Enter. Susanna looked bewildered and doubtful.
"What is this thing, do you think? It looks like a gadget in a science fiction movie."
"Of course it did," Eddie realized. Susanna had probably seen a home security system or two in her time. She had, after all, lived among the Manhattan rich, even if she had not been very enthusiastically accepted by them. But there was a world of difference between the electronics gear available in her when, 1963, and his own, which was 1987.
"We've never talked much about the differences either," he thought. "I wonder what she'd think if I told her Ronald Reagan was President of the United States when Roland snatched me. Probably that I was crazy." "It's a security system," he said.
Then, although his nerves and instincts screamed out against it, he forced himself to reach out with his right hand and thumb the talk-listen switch. There was no crackle of electricity, no deadly blue fire went racing up his arm, no sign that the thing was even still connected.
"Maybe Blaine is dead. Maybe he's dead after all."
But he didn't really believe that.
"Hello?"
he said, and in his mind's eye saw the unfortunate artist screaming as he was microwaved by the blue fire dancing all over his face and body, melting his eyes and setting his hair ablaze.
"Hello, Blaine? Anybody?"
He let go of the button and waited, stiff with tension. Susanna's hand crept into his, cold and small. There was still no answer, and Eddie, now more reluctant than ever, pushed the button again.
"Blaine?"
He let go of the button, waited, and when there was still no answer, a dangerous giddiness overcame him, as it often did in moments of stress and fear. When that giddiness took him, counting the cost no longer seemed to matter. Nothing mattered. It had been like that when he had outfaced Balazar's sallow-faced contact man in Nassau, and it was like that now. And if Roland had seen him in the moment this lunatic impatience overtook him, he would have seen more than just a resemblance between Eddie and Cuthbert. He would have sworn Eddie was Cuthbert. He jammed the button in with his thumb and began to bellow into the speaker, adopting a plummy and completely bogus British accent.
"Hello, Blaine. Cheerio, old fellow. This is Robin Leach, host of Lifestyles of the Rich and Brainless, here to tell you that you have won $6 billion and a new Ford Escort in the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes."
Pigeons took flight above them in soft, startled explosions of wings. Susanna gasped. Her face wore the dismayed expression of a devout woman who has just heard her husband blaspheme in a cathedral.
"Eddie, stop it! Stop it!"
Eddie couldn't stop it. His mouth was smiling, but his eyes glittered with a mixture of fear, hysteria, and frustrated anger.
You and your monorail girlfriend, Patricia, will spend a luxurious month in scenic Jimtown, where you'll drink only the finest wine and eat only the finest virgins.
Eddie broke off, looking at Susanna. He was at once sure that it had been she who had shushed him, not only because she had already tried, but because she was the only other person here. And yet at the same time he knew it hadn't been Susanna. That had been another voice, the voice of a very young and very frightened child.
Suze, did you?
Susanna was shaking her head and raising her hand at the same time. She pointed at the intercom box, and Eddie saw the button marked Command was glowing a very faint shell pink. It was the same color as the mono sleeping in its berth on the other side of the barrier.
"Don't wake him up,"
the child's voice mourned. It drifted from the speaker, soft as an evening breeze. "What?" Eddie began. Then he shook his head, reached toward the talk-listen switch, and pressed it gently. When he spoke again, it was not in the blaring Robin Leach bellow, but in the almost whisper of a conspirator.
"What are you? Who are you?"
He released the button. He and Susanna regarded each other with the big eyes of children who now know they are sharing the house with a dangerous, perhaps psychotic, adult. How have they come by the knowledge? Why, because another child has told them, a child who has lived with a psychotic adult for a long time, hiding in corners and stealing out only when it knows the adult is asleep, a frightened child who happens to be almost invisible. There was no answer. Eddie let the seconds spin out. Each one seemed long enough to read a whole novel in. He was reaching for the button again when the faint pink glow reappeared.
"I'm Little Blaine,"
the child's voice whispered.
"The one he doesn't see. The one he forgot. The one he thinks he left behind in the rooms of ruin and the halls of the dead."
Eddie pushed the button again with a hand that had picked up an uncontrollable shake. He could hear that shake in his voice as well.
Who is the one who doesn't see? Is it the bear?
No, not the bear, not he. Shardik lay dead in the forest, many miles behind them. The world had moved on, even since then. Eddie suddenly remembered what it had been like to lay his ear against that strange, unfound door in the clearing where the bear had lived its violent half-life, that door with its somehow terrible stripes of yellow and black. It was all of a piece, he realized now, all part of some awful, decaying whole, a tattered web with the dark tower at its center like an incomprehensible stone spider. All of Midworld had become one vast, haunted mansion in these strange latter days. All of Midworld had become the drawers. All of Midworld had become a wasteland, haunting and haunted. He saw Susanna's lips form the words of the real answer before the voice from the intercom could speak them, and those words were as obvious as the solution to a riddle once the answer is spoken.
"Big Blaine," the unseen voice whispered. "Big Blaine is the ghost in the machine, the ghost in all the machines."
Susanna's hand had gone to her throat and was clutching it as if she intended to strangle herself. Her eyes were full of terror, but they were not glassy, not stunned. They were sharp with understanding. Perhaps she knew a voice like this one from her own Wen, the Wen where the integrated whole that was Susanna had been shunted aside by the warring personalities of Detta and Odetta. The childish voice had surprised her as well as him, but her agonized eyes said she was no stranger to the concept being expressed. Susanna knew all about the madness of duality.
"Eddie, we have to go," she said.
Her terror turned the words into an unpunctuated auditory smear. He could hear air whistling in her windpipe like a cold wind around a chimney.
"Eddie, we have to get away. Eddie, we have to get away. Eddie, too late,"
the tiny mourning voice said.
"He's awake. Big Blaine is awake. He knows you are here, and he's coming."
Suddenly lights, bright orange arc sodiums, began to flash on in pairs above them, bathing the pillared vastness of the cradle in a harsh glare that banished all shadows. Hundreds of pigeons darted and swooped in frightened, aimless flight, startled from their complex of interlocked nests high above.
"Wait!" Eddie shouted. "Please wait!"
In his agitation, he forgot to push the button, but it made no difference. Little Blaine responded anyway.
"No, I can't let him catch me. I can't let him kill me, too."
The light on the intercom box went dark again, but only for a moment. This time both command and enter lit up, and their color was not pink, but the lurid dark red of a blacksmith's forge.
"Who are you?"
A voice roared, and it came not just from the box, but from every speaker in the city which still operated. The rotting bodies hanging from the poles shivered with the vibrations of that mighty voice. It seemed that even the dead would run from Blaine if they could. Susanna shrank back in her chair, the heels of her hands pressed to her ears, her face long with dismay, her mouth distorted in a silent scream. Eddie felt himself shrinking toward all the fantastic, hallucinatory terrors of 11. Had it been this voice he had feared when he and Henry stood outside the mansion, that he had perhaps even anticipated? He didn't know. But he did know how Jack in that old story must have felt when he realized that he had tried the beanstalk once too often and awakened the giant.
"How dare you disturb my sleep? Tell me now, or die where you stand."
He might have frozen right there, leaving Blaine, Big Blaine, to do to them whatever it was he had done to Artis, or something even worse. Perhaps should have frozen, locked in that down-the-rabbit-hole fairy-tale terror. It was the memory of the small voice which had spoken first that enabled him to move. It had been the voice of a terrified child, but it had tried to help them, terrified or not. "So now you have to help yourself," he thought. "You woke it up. Deal with it, for Christ's sake." Eddie reached out and pushed the button again.
"My name is Eddie Dean. The woman with me is my wife, Susanna. We're...
He looked at Susanna, who nodded and made frantic motions for him to go on.
"We're on a quest. We seek the Dark Tower, which lies in the path of the beam. We're in the company of two others, Roland of Gilead and Jake of New York. We're from New York, too. If you're..."
He paused for a moment, biting back the words Big Blaine. If he used them, he might make the intelligence behind the voice aware that they had heard another voice, a ghost inside the ghost, so to speak. Susanna gestured again for him to go on, using both hands.
"If you're Blaine the Mono, well, we want you to take us."
He released the button. There was no response for what seemed like a very long time, only the agitated flutter of the disturbed pigeons from overhead. When Blaine spoke again, his voice came only from the speaker box mounted on the gate and sounded almost human. "Do not try my patience. All the doors to that ware are closed. Gilead is no more, and those known as gunslingers are all dead. Now answer my question. Who are you? This is your last chance." There was a sizzling sound. A ray of brilliant blue-white light lanced down from the ceiling and seared a hole the size of a golf ball in the marble floor less than 5 feet to the left of Susanna's wheelchair. Smoke that smelled like the aftermath of a lightning bolt rose lazily from it. Susanna and Eddie stared at each other in mute terror for a moment, and then Eddie lunged for the communicator box and thumbed the button.
"You're wrong. We did come from New York. We came through the doors on the beach only a few weeks ago."
"It's true," Susanna called. "I swear it is."
Silence. Beyond the long barrier, Blaine's pink back humped smoothly. The window at the front seemed to regard them like a vapid glass eye. The wiper could have been a lid half-closed in a sly wink.
"Prove it," Blaine said at last.
"Christ, how do I do that?" Eddie asked Susanna.
"I don't know."
Eddie pushed the button again.
"The Statue of Liberty. Does that ring a bell?"
"Go on," Blaine said. Now the voice sounded almost thoughtful.
"The Empire State Building, the Stock Exchange, the World Trade Center, Coney Island Red Hots, Radio City Music Hall, the East Villa—"
Blaine cut him off. And now, incredibly, the voice which came from the speaker was the drawling voice of John Wayne.
"Okay, Pilgrim, I believe you."
Eddie and Susanna shared another glance, this one of confusion and relief. But when Blaine spoke again, the voice was again cold and emotionless. "Ask me a question, Eddie Dean of New York, and it better be a good one." There was a pause, and then Blaine added, "Because if it's not, you and your woman are going to die, no matter where you came from." Susanna looked from the box on the gate to Eddie.
"What's it talking about?"
she hissed. Eddie shook his head.
"I don't have the slightest idea."
28. To Jake, the room Gasher dragged him into looked like a Minuteman missile silo which had been decorated by the inmates of a lunatic asylum. Part museum, part living room, part hippie crash pad. Above him, empty space vaulted up to a rounded ceiling, and below him it dropped 75 or 100 feet to a similarly rounded base. Running all around the single curved wall in vertical lines were tubes of neon in alternating strokes of color. Red, blue, green, yellow, orange, peach, pink. These long tubes came together in roaring rainbow knots at the bottom and top of the silo, if that was what it had been. The room was about 3/4 of the way up the vast capsule-shaped space and floored with rusty iron grillwork. Rugs that looked Turkish, he later learned that such rugs were actually from a barony called Kashmin, lay on the grilled floor here and there. Their corners were held down with brass-bound trunks or standing lamps or the squat legs of overstuffed chairs. If not, they would have flapped like strips of paper tied to an electric fan, because a steady warm draft rushed up from below. Another draft, this one issuing from a circular band of ventilators like the ones in the tunnel they had followed here, swirled about 4 or 5 feet above Jake's head. On the far side of the room was a door identical to the one through which he and Gasher had entered, and Jake assumed it was a continuation of the subterranean corridor following the path of the beam. There were 6 people in the room, 4 men and 2 women. Jake guessed that he was looking at the Gray High Command, if, that was, there were enough Grays left to warrant a High Command. None of them were young, but all were still in the prime of their lives. They looked at Jake as curiously as he looked at them. Sitting in the center of the room, with one massive leg thrown casually over the arm of a chair big enough to be a throne, was a man who looked like a cross between a Viking warrior and a giant from a child's fairy tale. His heavily muscled upper body was naked except for a silver band around one bicep, a knife scabbard looped over one shoulder, and a strange charm about his neck. His lower body was clad in soft, tight-fitting leather breeches, which were tucked into high boots. He wore a yellow scarf tied around one of these. His hair, a dirty gray-blonde, cascaded almost to the middle of his broad back. His eyes were as green and curious as the eyes of a tomcat who is old enough to be wise, but not old enough to have lost that refined sense of cruelty which passes for fun in feline circles. Hung by its strap from the back of the chair was what looked like a very old machine gun. Jake looked more closely at the ornament on the Viking's chest and saw that it was a coffin-shaped glass box hung on a silver chain. Inside it, a tiny gold clock face marked the time at 3:05. Below the face, a tiny gold pendulum went back and forth, and despite the soft whoosh of circulating air from above and below, he could hear the tick-tock sound it made. The hands of the clock were moving faster than they should have done, and Jake was not very surprised to see that they were moving backward. He thought of the crocodile in Peter Pan, the one that was always chasing after Captain Hook, and a little smile touched his lips. Gasher saw it and raised his hand. Jake cringed away, putting his own hands to his face. The tick-tock man shook his finger at Gasher in an amusing schoolmarmish gesture.
Now, no need of that, Gasher," he said.
Gasher lowered his hand at once. His face had changed completely. Before, it had alternated between stupid rage and a species of cunning, almost existential humor. Now he only looked servile and adoring. Like the others in the room, and Jake himself, the Gasher man could not look away from Tick-Tock for long. His eyes were drawn inexorably back. And Jake could understand why. The Tick-Tock man was the only person here who seemed wholly vital, wholly healthy, and wholly alive.
"If ye say there's no need, there ain't," Gasher said.
But he favored Jake with a dark look before shifting his eyes back to the blonde giant on the throne.
"Still, he's very pert, Tiki, very pert, Tiki, very pert indeed, so he is. And if you want my opinion, he'll take a deal of training."
"When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it," the TikTok man said. "Now close the door, Gash. Was you born in a barn?"
A dark-haired woman laughed shrilly, a sound like the caw of a crow. TikTok flicked his eyes toward her. She quieted at once and cast her eyes down to the grilled floor. The door through which Gasher had dragged him was actually two doors. The arrangement reminded Jake of the way spaceship airlocks looked in the more intelligent science fiction movies. Gasher shut them both and turned to TikTok, giving him a thumbs-up gesture. The TikTok man nodded and reached languidly up to press a button set into a piece of furniture that looked like a speaker's podium. A pump began to cycle wheezily within the wall, and the neon tubes dimmed perceptibly. There was a faint hiss of air, and the valve wheel of the inside door spun shut. Jake supposed the one in the outer door was doing the same. This was some sort of bomb shelter, all right, no doubt of that. When the pump died, the long neon tubes resumed their former muted brilliance.
"There," TikTok said pleasantly.
His eyes began to look Jake up and down. Jake had a clear and very uncomfortable sense of being expertly catalogued and filed.
"All safe and sound we are. Snug as bugs in a rug, right, Hoots?"
"We are,"
a tall, skinny man in a black suit replied promptly. His face was covered with some sort of rash, which he scratched obsessively.
"I brung him," Gasher said. "I told you you could trust me to do it, and didn't I?"
"You did," TikTok said. "Bang on. I had some doubts about your ability to remember the password at the end there," but the dark-haired woman uttered another shrill caw.
The TikTok man half-turned in her direction, that lazy smile dimpling the corners of his mouth, and before Jake was able to grasp what was happening, what had already happened, she was staggering backward, her eyes bulging in surprise and pain, her hands groping at some strange tumor in the middle of her chest, which hadn't been there a second before. Jake realized the TikTok man had made some sort of move as he was turning, a move so quick it had been no more than a flicker. The slim white hilt which had protruded from the scabbard looped over the TikTok man's shoulder was gone. The knife was now on the other side of the room, sticking out of the dark-haired woman's chest. TikTok had drawn and thrown with an uncanny speed Jake wasn't sure even Roland could match. It had been like some malign magic trick. The others watched silently as the woman staggered toward TikTok, gagging harshly, her hands wrapped loosely around the hilt of the knife. Her hip bumped one of the standing lamps, and the one called Hoots darted forward to catch it before it could fall. TikTok himself never moved. He only went on sitting with his leg tossed over the arm of his throne, watching the woman with his lazy smile. Her foot caught beneath one of the rugs, and she tumbled forward. Once more the TikTok man moved with that spooky speed, pulling back the foot which had been dangling over the arm of the chair, and then driving it forward again like a piston. It buried itself in the pit of the dark-haired woman's stomach, and she went flying backward. Blood spewed from her mouth and splattered the furniture. She struck the wall, slid down it, and ended up sitting with her chin on her breastbone. To Jake, she looked like a movie Mexican taking a siesta against an adobe wall. It was hard for him to believe she had gone from living to dead with such terrible speed. Neon tubes turned her hair into a haze that was half red and half blue. Her glazing eyes stared at the TikTok man with terminal amazement.
"I told her about that laugh," TikTok said.
His eyes shifted to the other woman, a heavy-set redhead who looked like a long-haul trucker.
"Didn't I, Tilly?"
"Aye,"
Tilly said at once. Her eyes were lustrous with fear and excitement, and she licked her lips obsessively.
"So you did, many and many a time. I'll set my watch and ward on it."
"So you might, if you could reach up your fat ass far enough to find them," TikTok said. "Bring me my knife, Brandon, and mind you wipe that slut stink off it before you put it in my hand."
A short, bandy-legged man hopped to do as he had been bidden. The knife wouldn't come free at first. It seemed caught on the unfortunate dark-haired woman's breastbone.
Brandon threw a terrified glance over his shoulder at the TikTok man and then tugged harder. TikTok, however, appeared to have forgotten all about both Brandon and the woman who had literally laughed herself to death. His brilliant green eyes had fixed on something which interested him much more than the dead woman. "Come here, Cully," he said. "I want a better look at you." Gasher gave him a shove. Jake stumbled forward. He would have fallen if TikTok's strong hands hadn't caught him by the shoulders. Then, when he was sure Jake had his balance again, TikTok grasped the boy's left wrist and raised it. It was Jake's Seiko which had drawn his interest. "If this here's what I think it is, it's an omen for sure and true," TikTok said. "Talk to me, boy. What's this sigil you wear?" Jake, who hadn't the slightest idea what a sigil was, could only hope for the best. "It's a watch. But it doesn't work, Mr. TikTok." Hoots chuckled at that, then clapped both hands over his mouth when the TikTok man turned to look at him. After a moment, TikTok looked back at Jake, and a sunny smile replaced the frown. Looking at that smile almost made you forget that it was a dead woman and not a movie Mexican taking a siesta over there against the wall. Looking at it almost made you forget that these people were crazy, and the TikTok man was likely the craziest inmate in the whole asylum. "Watch," TikTok said, nodding. "Aye, a likely enough name for such. After all, what does a person want with a timepiece but to watch it once in a while? I Brandon, I Tilly, I Gasher?" They responded with eager affirmatives. The TikTok man favored them with his winning smile, then turned back to Jake again. Now Jake noticed that the smile, winning or not, stopped well short of the TikTok man's green eyes. They were as they had been throughout, cool, cruel, and curious. He reached a finger toward the Seiko, which now proclaimed the time to be 7:91 a.m. and p.m., and pulled it back just before touching the glass above the liquid crystal display. "Tell me, dear boy, is this watch of yours booby-rigged?" "Huh? Oh, no. No, it's not booby-rigged." Jake touched his own finger to the face of the watch. "That means nothing if it's set to the frequency of your own body," the TikTok man said. He spoke in the sharp, scornful tone Jake's father used when he didn't want people to figure out that he didn't have the slightest idea what he was talking about. TikTok glanced briefly at Brandon, and Jake saw him weigh the pros and cons of making the bow-legged man his designated toucher. Then he dismissed the notion and looked back into Jake's eyes. "If this thing gives me a shock, my little friend, you're going to be choking to death on your own sweetmeats in 30 seconds. Jake swallowed hard but said nothing. The TikTok man reached out his finger again and this time allowed it to settle on the face of the Seiko. The moment that it did, all the numbers went to zeros and then began to count upward again. TikTok's eyes had narrowed in a grimace of potential pain as he touched the face of the watch. Now their corners crinkled in the first genuine smile Jake had seen from him. He thought it was partly pleasure at his own courage, but mostly simple wonder and interest. "May I have it?" he asked Jake silkily, "as a gesture of your good will, shall we say. I am something of a clock fancier, my dear young collie, so I am." "Be my guest." Jake stripped the watch off his arm at once and dropped it onto the TikTok man's large, waiting palm.
"Talks just like a little silk-arse gentleman, don't he?" Gasher said happily. "In old days someone would have paid a very high price for the return of such as him, Tiki. Aye, so they would. Why, my father, your father, died so blowed out rotten with the mandrus that not even the dogs would eat him," the TikTok man interrupted. "Now shut up, you idiot."
At first Gasher looked furious, and then only abashed. He sank into a nearby chair and closed his mouth. TikTok, meanwhile, was examining the Seiko's expansion band with an expression of awe. He pulled it wide, let it snap back, pulled it wide again, let it snap back again. He dropped a lock of his hair into the open links, then laughed when they closed on it. At last he slipped the watch over his hand and pushed it halfway up his forearm. Jake thought this souvenir of New York looked very strange there, but said nothing.
"Wonderful!" TikTok exclaimed. "Where did you get it, Cully?"
It was a birthday present for my father and mother, Jake said. Gasher leaned forward at this, perhaps wanting to mention the idea of ransom again. If so, the intent look on the TikTok man's face changed his mind, and he sat back without saying anything. Was it? TikTok marveled, raising his eyebrows. He had discovered the small button which lit the face of the watch and kept pushing it, watching the light go off and on. Then he looked back at Jake, and his eyes were narrowed to bright green slits again. Tell me something, Kelly. Does this run on a dipolar or unipolar circuit?
Neither one, Jake said, not knowing that his failure to say he did not know what either of these terms meant was buying him a great deal of future trouble.
It runs on a nickel-cadmium battery. At least, I'm pretty sure it does. I've never had to replace it, and I lost the instruction folder a long time ago.
The TikTok man looked at him for a long time without speaking, and Jake realized with dismay that the blonde man was trying to decide if Jake had been making fun of him. If he decided Jake had been making fun, Jake had an idea that the abuse he had suffered on the way here would seem like tickling compared to what the TikTok man might do. He suddenly wanted to divert TikTok's train of thought, wanted that more than anything in the world. He said the first thing he thought might turn the trick.
He was your grandfather, wasn't he?
The TikTok man raised his brows interrogatively. His hands returned to Jake's shoulders, and although his grip was not tight, Jake could feel the phenomenal strength there. If TikTok chose to tighten his grip and pull sharply forward, he would snap Jake's collarbones like pencils. If he shoved, he would probably break his back.
Who was my grandfather, Kelly?
Jake's eyes once more took in the TikTok man's massive, nobly shaped head and broad shoulders. He remembered what Susanna had said. Look at the size of him, Roland. They must have had to grease him to get him into the cockpit.
The man in the airplane. David Quick.
The TikTok man's eyes widened in surprise and amazement. Then he threw back his head and roared out a gust of laughter that echoed off the domed ceiling high above. The others smiled nervously. None, however, dared to laugh right out loud, not after what had happened to the woman with the dark hair.
Whoever you are and wherever you come from, boy, you're the triggest cove old TikTok's run into for many a year.
Quick was my great-grandfather, not my grandfather, but you're close enough. Wouldn't you say so, Gasher, my dear?
Aye, Gasher said. He's trig right enough. I could have told you that, but we're pert all the same.
Yes, the TikTok man said thoughtfully. His hands tightened on the boy's shoulders and drew Jake closer to that smiling, handsome, lunatic face.
I can see he's pert. It's in his eyes. But we'll take care of that, won't we, Gasher?
It's not Gasher he's talking to, Jake thought. It's me. He thinks he's hypnotizing me. And maybe he is.
Aye, Gasher breathed.
Jake felt he was drowning in those wide green eyes. Although the TikTok man's grip was still not really tight, he couldn't get enough breath into his lungs. He summoned all of his own force in an effort to break the blond man's hold over him, and again spoke the first words which came to mind.
So fell Lord Perth, and the countryside did shake with that thunder.
It acted upon TikTok like a hard, open-handed blow to the face. He recoiled, green eyes narrowing, his grip on Jake's shoulders tightening painfully.
What do you say? Where did you hear that?
A little bird told me,
Jake replied with calculated insolence, and the next instant he was flying across the room. If he had struck the curved wall head first, he would have been knocked cold or killed. As it happened, he struck on one hip, rebounded, and landed in a heap on the iron grillwork. He shook his head groggily, looked around, and found himself face to face with the woman who was not taking a siesta. He uttered a shocked cry and crawled away on his hands and knees. Hoots kicked him in the chest, flipping him onto his back. Jake lay there, gasping, looking up at the knot of rainbow colors where the neon tubes came together. A moment later, TikTok's face filled his field of vision. The man's lips were pressed together in a hard, straight line, his cheeks flared with color, and there was fear in his eyes.
The coffin-shaped glass ornament he wore around his neck dangled directly in front of Jake's eyes, swinging gently back and forth on its silver chain as if imitating the pendulum of the tiny grandfather clock inside.
"Gasher's right," he said.
He gathered a handful of Jake's shirt into one fist and pulled him up.
"You're pert. But you don't want to be pert with me, Cully. You don't ever want to be pert with me. Have you heard of people with short fuses? Well, I have no fuse at all. And there's a good 1,000 could testify to it if I hadn't stilled their tongues for good. If you ever speak to me of Lord Perth again, ever, 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 I'll tear off the top of your skull and eat your brains. I'll have none of that bad luck story in the Cradle of the Greys. Do you understand me?"
He shook Jake back and forth like a rag, and the boy burst into tears.
"Do you?"
"Yes."
"Good."
He set Jake upon his feet, where he swayed woozily back and forth, wiping at his streaming eyes and leaving smudges of dirt on his cheeks so dark they looked like mascara.
"Now, my little cull, we're going to have a question-and-answer session here. I'll ask the questions and you'll give the answers. Do you understand?"
Jake didn't reply. He was looking at a panel of the ventilator grill which circled the chamber. The TikTok man grabbed his nose between two of his fingers and squeezed it viciously.
"Do you understand me?"
"Yes,"
Jake cried. His eyes, now watering with pain as well as terror, returned to TikTok's face. He wanted to look back at the ventilator grill, wanted desperately to verify that what he had seen there was not simply a trick of his frightened, overloaded mind, but he didn't dare. He was afraid someone else, TikTok himself, most likely, would follow his gaze and see what he had seen.
"Good."
TikTok pulled Jake back over to the chair by his nose, sat down, and cocked his leg over the arm again.
"Let's have a nice little chin, then. We'll begin with your name, shall we? Just what might that be, Cully?"
"Jake Chambers."
With his nose pinched shut, his voice sounded nasal and foggy.
"And are you a Nazi, Jake Chambers?"
For a moment, Jake wondered if this was a peculiar way of asking him if he was blind. But, of course, they could all see he wasn't.
"I don't understand what..."
TikTok shook him back and forth by the nose.
"Nazi, Nazi, you just want to stop playing with me, boy."
"I don't understand..."
Jake began, and then he looked at the old machine gun hanging from the chair and thought once more of the crashed Fokker Wolf. The pieces fell together in his mind.
"No! I'm not a Nazi. I'm an American. All that ended long before I was born."
The TikTok man released his hold on Jake's nose, which immediately began to gush blood.
"You could have told me that in the first place and saved yourself all sorts of pain, Jake Chambers. But at least now you understand how we do things around here, don't you?"
Jake nodded.
"Aye, well enough. We'll start with the simple questions."
Jake's eyes drifted back to the ventilator grill. What he had seen before was still there. It hadn't been just his imagination. Two gold-ringed eyes floated in the dark behind the chrome louvers.
"Oi!"
TikTok slapped his face, knocking him back into Gasher, who immediately pushed him forward again.
"It's school time, dear heart," Gasher whispered. "Mind your lessons now. Mind 'em very sharp."
"Look at me when I'm talking to you," TikTok said. "I'll have some respect, Jake Chambers, or I'll have your balls."
"All right."
TikTok's green eyes gleamed dangerously.
"All right, what?"
Jake groped for the right answer, pushing away the tangle of questions and the sudden hope which had dawned in his mind, and what came was what would have served at his own cradle of the pubes, otherwise known as the Piper School.
"All right, sir."
TikTok smiled.
"That's a start, boy," he said, and leaned forward, forearms on his thighs. "Now, what's an American?"
Jake began to talk, trying with all his might not to look toward the ventilator grill as he did so.